Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Good to be back.
Today we're looking into something really fascinating, Kurdish male traditions. We've got some research here that gives us a window into the customs, the roles, the responsibilities, basically what has shaped men's identities in Kurdish society.
Right, and across different regions too, and over time, it's not a simple picture.
Not at all. And the sources make it clear these traditions aren't set in stone. They're constantly shifting.
Absolutely. Influenced by history, social structures, economics, politics, even the fact that Kurdistan is divided across Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria, that plays a huge role.
And this enduring reality of statelessness, that seems to have had a unique impact, hasn't it? Turning these traditions into, well, really powerful tools for keeping culture alive, for maintaining identity.
It really has. It's quite striking how the lack of a state seems to amplify the importance of these male traditions. They become these really potent markers of being Kurdish.
Especially when you think about the pressures towards assimilation in the different countries.
Exactly. Our sources even point out how some traditions, like having large families, have sometimes been seen by men as almost a strategy, a way to ensure the survival of Kurdish culture itself. And then there's the incredible role of the Dengbej, the bards. Predominantly men, keeping history and culture alive just through speaking, through singing.
Which is absolutely vital when, the written language might be restricted or discouraged.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's dig into this a bit. The foundation of a Kurdish man's identity. It seems so deeply connected to the patrilineal system, right? Tracing everything through the father's line.
That's right. That system really dictates so much social organization, status, inheritance. Pretty much the works.
So how does it shape the society specifically? What does the research say?
Well, lineages form clans, clans form tribes, and historically this dictated things like land ownership, political influence, especially within those tribal structures.
Okay.
The male head of the family is the central figure, and there's a huge emphasis on mutual support, shared identity, particularly among the male relatives.
And within that structure, there's this very strong preference for a specific kind of marriage. The father's brother's daughter, FBD marriage.
Yes, that comes up again and again in the research.
Why is that preference so strong? What are the sort of underlying reasons?
Well, it's interesting. It seems to be multi-layered. It's not just about keeping the family close, although that's definitely part of it.
Right.
It also helps keep property resources within that male line, the patrilineage, and it reinforces the authority of the men in the family and the solidarity of the group.
So less romance, more strategy for the family unit.
You could say that, yeah. Our research suggests it's seen as a strategically sound move for the family.
But it's interesting, the sources also mention this can create tensions internally, especially around things like, say, dividing land.
That's a really important point. It shows the kind of duality of these tight-knit kinship structures.
How so?
Well, they offer immense strength, immense support, especially when there's conflict. But that intense focus on close male relatives, the agnatic ties, it can also be a source of friction. Disputes, especially between brothers over land, they're not uncommon. And Kurdish men are expected to handle these complex internal dynamics just as skillfully as they handle, external relations.
And if they don't?
Well, the sources highlight instances where disputes, if not handled according to tradition, could really escalate within the community.
Right. Okay, moving beyond kinship then, let's talk about the traditional roles within the family, the community. The man as head of household, the manchvi. What does that actually involve day to day?
That's a role with significant weight, definitely. The expectation is the man governs family affairs, he's the main economic provider, and he ensures the safety, and this is crucial, the honor, the namus of his family.
And the division of labor seems quite defined, at least historically. Men out working the land, managing livestock.
Right. Or as economies changed, engaging in wage labor, maybe moving to cities.
How has modernization affected that?
What's quite noticeable is how adaptable these roles seem to be while still keeping that core expectation of the man providing.
Okay.
So even with modernization, that underlying cultural expectation remains strong. A man's sense of self-worth can really be tied to his ability to fulfill that economic role.
So even if they migrate for work, sending money back reinforces it.
Exactly. Their remittances, the continued support for the family back home, it all ties back into that traditional role.
Now, we also read about the aga, the traditional lineage or clan leader. That role sounds historically quite important.
Oh, absolutely. Historically, the aga was often a central figure. They'd frequently maintain a village guest house, a mevangsin or devangsin.
The guest house?
Yeah, and it was more than just for guests. It was a hub for social gatherings, discussions, entertaining visitors, a real center of village life. And in return, they'd receive tribute, support from the villagers.
So these weren't just places for travelers. They were vital social spaces, especially for men.
Precisely. Crucial for reinforcing community bonds, sharing news, basically the heart of informal political life in the village.
But that's waned over time, right?
It has, yes. Our sources note that the influence of the aga and these formal guest houses has decreased. Leaders moved to towns. Land ownership patterns changed.
Interesting. So what replaced them?
Well, interestingly, as those declined, local tea houses seem to have become more and more important as gathering places for men, maybe signaling a shift to more decentralized social interaction.
Right. Makes sense. Let's shift gears slightly to the life cycle. What are some key moments of transitions for a Kurdish male?
Well, starting young, childhood itself is marked by important rituals, naming ceremonies, for instance. The name chosen often reflects family hopes, cultural values, sometimes even nationalistic or religious feelings.
And the oral traditions start early, too, shaping how a boy sees the world.
Definitely. And then there's circumcision katne, or sunnet. That's a really pivotal rite of passage.
Marking that progression towards manhood, integration into the community, both culturally and religiously.
Exactly.
Are there unique customs tied to it in different areas?
Yes. One particularly interesting one, according to the research, comes from some Syrian Kurdish communities. It's the role of the kiv.
The kiv.
Yes. This is an honored person, often a family friend, who physically holds the child during the circumcision ceremony.
Wow.
And this creates this incredibly profound bond, a kind of fictive kinship between the two families. It's considered so strong, it actually creates an incest taboo between them.
That's powerful. Extending the social network right there, beyond just blood ties.
Absolutely. The kiv often gives gifts, offers support. It really solidifies a lifelong relationship. It just shows how deeply these social contracts are woven into this society.
And education, what role does that play traditionally?
Traditionally, young boys often started their education with religious instruction, learning from a mullah or a sheikh.
Learning religious principles, basic literacy.
Yeah.
That's usually separate from girls, right?
Yes, typically in separate settings. This early religious education was fundamental. It wasn't just about religion, but also instilling cultural norms, providing that basic literacy needed for adult life.
And adulthood isn't just marked by marriage, is it? There are other things.
No, marriage is major, obviously. But historically, things like skill with weapons, the ability to defend your family, those were vital markers, too. And more broadly, you know, a man's continued affirmation of manhood really depends on his ability to provide and uphold that family honor, the namus.
So a mix of meeting expectations and practical skills. Okay, marriage itself. Huge topic. We touched on FBD marriage, but the whole process sounds quite complex.
It really is. Traditionally, marriages are arranged by the families. Often starts with discussions among the women, actually.
Oh, interesting.
Then the men step in to finalize things, especially the marriage settlement and the next.
The bride wealth.
Exactly. And it's interesting. The research notes the bride wealth is often lower in those FBD cousin marriages, sort of another incentive.
Right. And the groom's family pays for the wedding.
Typically, yes. They cover the expenses.
And this bride wealth system. It seems like more than just an economic thing.
Oh, definitely. It has strategic dimensions. Yeah. It's about continuing the lineage, managing property, affirming social status.
Right.
Our sources even mention other forms like exchange marriages, sister exchange, for example, which bypass bride wealth entirely. Again, showing how marriage can be a direct way to forge alliances.
Makes sense. And polygyny. Multiple wives.
It's permitted in Islamic tradition, but the research suggests it's actually pretty rare among Kurds, usually associated with men who have significant economic and social standing.
Which makes sense, given the cost of supporting multiple households.
Exactly. And the sources also mention that childlessness in a first marriage can be a socially accepted reason for a man to take a second wife, or sometimes for divorce.
And the weddings themselves sound incredible. Mm-hmm. Vibrant, communal.
Oh, yes. Especially in rural areas. They can last for days. Big celebrations, and men have specific roles. Well, the groom, or sometimes his brother, might throw sweets and money from the roof when the bride arrives at her new home. Little traditions like that.
And the music, the dancing, integral parts.
Absolutely. Men participate really enthusiastically in the traditional group dances, like the govind or halparke. You really feel that sense of community, of shared celebration.
Okay, let's move into the cultural expressions of manhood now.
Mm.
Oral traditions seem incredibly important here.
Hugely important, especially in a context where, as we said, the written Kurdish language has faced suppression. Oral tradition becomes the main highway for transmitting history, culture, values.
And the Dengbej, the bards, are key to this.
Central figures, revered, predominantly men, and they are essentially living libraries. They preserve and share Kurdish history, epics, these long narrative poems called laj or lawik, and cultural stories just through their vocal performances.
It's more than just reciting stories, though, isn't it? What's the deeper significance?
What's really fascinating is the depth of their knowledge, and their role goes beyond just entertainment. They're keepers of a counter-narrative, you could say.
How so?
They often offer distinctly Kurdish perspectives on historical events, which is so, so vital for a people without a state. Their performances can even carry political undertones. It makes them really important figures culturally and sometimes even politically.
And it's not just the Dengbej.
No, there are also storytellers, Sirokbej, and minstrels, Stronbej, often men too, mm-hmm. who add to this rich oral heritage.
Then there's the traditional closing. Silu Berjen Kurdi. So visually distinctive.
And carrying so much cultural weight, it really does.
There are regional differences, right?
Yes, like the Shelu Shupik in central Kurdistan mm. or the Kortek Ujalvar further south. But regardless of the specific style, these clothes are powerful symbols of Kurdish identity, of cultural pride.
Especially during celebrations like Newroz or weddings?
Exactly. And you have essential elements like the Peshtwin, that wide waist sash, and all the different types of headwear, the semedani, the Kurdish kefiye, the claw cap, various turban styles, they all contribute to this visual representation of Kurdishness.
What's the deeper meaning behind the clothes, according to the research?
Well, what's particularly interesting is the symbolism woven into them. Specific colors, patterns, the style itself can indicate things like tribal affiliation, where someone's from, sometimes even political leanings.
Wow.
And in places where Kurdish culture has faced suppression, just wearing traditional clothes can be a really potent act of cultural resistance, a public statement of identity.
We have to talk about Newroz, the Kurdish New Year.
Absolutely, March 21st. It's so much more than just the start of spring.
It's a symbol of renewal, rebirth, resistance too, isn't it? And the hope for freedom.
Exactly. And men play very active, very visible roles in the celebrations.
Wearing their best traditional outfits.
Right. Participating in torchlight processions, lighting the big bonfires, and joining in those traditional dances with real enthusiasm.
And you can see how, in regions where expressing Kurdish culture is difficult, taking part in Newroz becomes an even bigger statement.
A very significant act of cultural resistance and political assertion, too, sometimes.
Are there traditional sports associated with manhood?
Yes. Traditional sports and pastimes also highlight valued skills. Things like wrestling, hunting, marksmanship, and equestrian sports like siret, a kind of horseback javelin game.
So not just for fun, but developing skills.
Exactly. Historically, these activities helped develop physical strength, strategy, skills that were pretty essential in the often challenging environment of Kurdistan.
Okay, finally, we need to touch on two foundational ethical principles. Hospitality, mevanperweri, and honor. Namus.
Absolutely central to Kurdish social life. Kurdish hospitality is legendary, really, often described as going far beyond what's expected.
And traditionally, men, especially leaders, heads of families, have the main responsibility for offering it.
Yes, sometimes maintaining those dedicated guest houses we mentioned. But even today, that ethos is strong. Men often insisting on paying for guests, readily offering help. It's seen as a marker of status, a way to build social capital.
And then namus, honor. It's a complex concept.
Very multifaceted. It covers honor, virtue, integrity, and it applies to both men and women, but in different ways.
So for men, what does upholding namus involve?
For a man, it involves maintaining his own moral reputation, his integrity, and crucially, safeguarding the honor of his family, especially the female members of the family.
And this is taken very seriously.
Extremely seriously. Our sources highlight instances where disputes, sometimes even violent ones, have historically erupted over perceived insults to a family's namus. It just underscores how profoundly significant this concept is. A perceived violation can have severe consequences.
Right. Lastly, funerary customs.
These are shaped by a mix of Islamic principles and unique local traditions. Men usually take the lead in the public parts of funerals and burials. The washing, the shrouding, the funeral prayer, the burial itself, all following Islamic rites for prompt burial.
Are there specific Kurdish traditions too?
Yes, there are. Like the chamari ceremony, which is observed in some regions for prominent men who've passed away. It involves elaborate rituals, special elegiac poetry, sometimes displaying the deceased's belongings.
And in areas affected by conflict, like Rojava.
Their funerals, especially for those considered martyrs, have taken on a really pronounced political dimension. They become public events demonstrating grief, yes, but also resilience and commitment to the Kurdish cause.
So across all these areas, social structure, family, culture, ethics, we see this incredibly rich, complex picture of Kurdish male traditions.
Definitely. A real tapestry.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh, Hannah.
Rojbosh.
Ah, this chai smells wonderful today. Is that a hint of cinnamon I'm getting? Or maybe cardamom?
It has a lovely warmth to it. Not too bitter at all today, actually.
Just the right amount of sweetness, I think. Perfect. Okay, let's just take a moment to enjoy this before we carry on.
Good idea.
Welcome back. Okay, so we've laid out this broad picture of traditions. Now, let's get into the regional variations a bit more. Across Bakur in Turkey, Bashur in Iraq, Roshilat in Iran, and Rojava in Syria. How have the different political situations, the social contexts, shaped these customs differently?
Right, because the experience has been quite different in each part.
Exactly. And major historical events must have had an impact, too. Thinking about something like the Anfal campaign in Bashur, in Iraqi Kurdistan, how might that have specifically affected male roles and traditions there? The sheer scale of violence, the targeting of men.
Well, the Anfal was devastating, particularly targeting men and boys of fighting age. This led to a massive loss of life, displacement, and the destruction of thousands of villages. You can imagine the profound impact on family structures, on traditional leadership roles.
Huge gaps left in communities.
Exactly. Women often had to take on roles previously held by men simply out of necessity. And the trauma, the collective memory of Anfal, undoubtedly shaped and continues to shape male identity and responsibilities in Bashur, perhaps emphasizing resilience, survival, and the duty to rebuild and protect the community.
And maybe a stronger connection to the Peshmerga identity as protectors.
Quite possibly, yes. And compare that, say, to the experience in Roshilat, Iran. Maybe thinking about the brief period of the Republic of Mahabad.
Right, that short-lived Kurdish Republic in 1946. Did that leave a specific mark on male traditions there?
Well, Mahabad, although brief, was a powerful symbol of Kurdish statehood and self-determination. It likely fostered a strong sense of national identity among men involved, emphasizing roles related to nation-building, administration, and military organization, even if it was ultimately crushed. That legacy, that aspiration, might still resonate in cultural expressions and political consciousness among men in Roshilat.
And then you have the ongoing influences. Modernization, people moving to cities, different political movements in each region, all constantly reshaping things.
Absolutely. Urbanization changes economic roles, family structures, modern education offers different pathways, and political movements, whether nationalist or otherwise, actively engage with and sometimes try to redefine traditional notions of masculinity. It's a very dynamic situation.
So when we look at everything we've discussed today, it's clear that Kurdish male traditions are this incredibly resilient but also evolving tapestry.
Yeah.
Deeply woven into Kurdish identity.
Definitely. We've seen how these traditions, kinship, family roles, cultural expressions like the dengbej, ethical codes like hospitality and honor, they've all served as these vital ways to maintain cultural continuity, social cohesion.
Especially, as we keep saying, in the face of all the historical and ongoing challenges.
Right. And we've also really highlighted the significant differences across Kurdistan. These traditions aren't monolithic at all. They're actively shaped by the specific political, economic, social landscapes in Bakur, Bashur, Roshilat, Rojava.
The influence of big historical events, modernization, political movements, it really underscores how dynamic these customs are.
Mm-hmm.
You see core values persisting, but also real adaptation to new situations.
Absolutely. When you consider the power of oral tradition to keep history alive, the symbolic weight of traditional clothing for identity, the community spirit in something like Newroz, and just how fundamental hospitality and honor are,
right.
Understanding these male traditions really offers profound insights into the heart of Kurdish society itself.
And looking ahead, the future of these traditions,
It's
going to continue to be this fascinating interplay, isn't it? Between honoring heritage and needing to navigate a rapidly changing world.
Leading to new expressions, new understandings of Kurdish masculinity, no doubt.
So as you, our listener, reflect on our conversation today, maybe think about how the traditions we've explored, that emphasis on lineage, the responsibilities in the family and community, the cultural expressions, the ethical codes, how might they resonate with or differ from traditions in other cultures you know?
That's a great point. What does the resilience, the adaptation of these Kurdish male traditions tell us about the enduring power of culture, especially when faced with immense challenges?
Something perhaps to ponder further as you go about your day.